The House of Representatives has now passed a Defense Authorization Act for 2015. It approves $585 billion in defense spending. Roger Zackheim's counsel for Covington and Burling, former general counsel and deputy staff director for the House Armed Services Committee, and looking at the details of the bill. Roger, you know exactly how this sausage gets made. When you look at what we're learning about the NDAA for this year, what do you see that jumps out at you on first blush? Thanks for coming on, Roger.
Well, Francis, thanks for having me on. Always great talking with you. You know, what's significant in this bill, I think, are two or three things. One, you have the authorization or continued authorization for the Train Equip Authority for Syria opposition forces. So that was something that they got done not too long ago, but they needed an extended authorization, and the NDAA provides that. So that's quite significant for the warfighters and military operating over in Iraq. The second piece was there's a big debate between the House and Senate over the extent that this measure would trim retirement and benefits. The outcome of this of the bill was that they did a more limited reduction in terms of benefits, a slight increase in TRICARE for life, as well as the pharmacy copays. So that was kind of the outcome of the bill that was somewhat in question. It favored the House position in that respect. And then overall, you have the authorization of funding, pretty significant overseas contingency operations, the war funding, as well as the base budget, where they really stayed at the bipartisan budget act, kind of slightly above sequester levels.
When I look, you mentioned the ILCO, and I hadn't planned to get into that too much, but it strikes me that we're in a situation where, you know, if you and I would have had this conversation 2 or 3 years ago, we might have talked about the scale down and eventual elimination of the overseas contingency operation budget. Is that kind of a moot point now? Is that unlikely to happen in your view over the next several years, that ILCO will eventually get smaller enough that it can just go away?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it's a moot point, but I think you're raising it because the assumptions are probably changing, and then there's going to be a discussion amongst policymakers and politicians over, are we going to sign up for that? I don't think you've had a serious debate today about what level of ILCO funding are people prepared to live with. Certainly, you know, in the out years, so the next fiscal year, but the years following, FY 17, 18, and 19. And with the residual force remaining in Afghanistan of 10,000, continued deployment, increased deployment of U.S. forces in Iraq, Ebola, and kind of everything else coming up day-to-day in that mix, you know, ILCO seems to be the go-to place to address those issues. So, you know, there's nearly $70 billion in this bill. I think next year, you're not going to see a dramatic reduction. Certainly, it's not going to be, you know, just, you know, $10 billion or less. I mean, you're talking tens of billion dollars, $30 to $40 billion at the very least, if not more.
Yeah, and it's not just those issues, Roger. I think about Russia doing war games in the English Channel and in North America, and I think about China staking claims in the East China Sea and South China Sea. I mean, these don't normally, historically, these kinds of things don't end well as far as our men and women staying out of these fights. I'm not proposing they're happening anytime soon, but it seems to make sense to have some kind of funding mechanism available in case some of these things do go south.
Let me take those points on, because you mentioned some of the challenges, in at least respect to China, that are there percolating, but haven't fully ripened. In the case of Russia, they have in Ukraine, but it could be manifest in other areas, you know, NATO allies. And so we need to increase our readiness, increase our capabilities to deal with those challenges. But the place to do that, as you know, is not an overseas contingency operations, you know, war supplemental that's off budget. The place to do it is the base budget, to get the base budget funding these priorities that you're building capability to, you know, allow for kind of recapitalization, not simply resetting the force. And that brings us back to sequestration. That brings us back to the fact that the budget has this artificial cap over it that's not allowing the department to really care for, provide for the priorities that, you know, are required to deal with the problems you've outlined.
You present a great case, Counselor, and I'm not suggesting that these issues should be taken up in the war spending budget, but given the reality that the Congress and Pentagon has to work under, the numbers that they haven't chosen to change yet, at least as far as Congress is concerned, that's the most logical way to do it within the framework that exists today. I understand you're suggesting we change the framework, but that hasn't happened yet. And so thinking about living how we may be forced to live with the framework that we have seems to be a logical train of progression at this point.
No, you're right. And it's like the worst kept secret in the defense community
right.
is that you fund priorities that you can't get in the base budget in the OCO. But, you know, at a certain point, you're going to have to be grown-ups about it and recognize that's a fairly short-sighted way to deal with fundamental problems. But Francis, I get your point. I would say that you're right, that we should, in the near term, we should expect seeing the same behavior.
Roger Zackheim of Covington Burling's my guest, former staffer on the House Armed Services Committee, looking at the National Defense Authorization Act. What's the significance here of this 51 years in a row? This is now going to be 52, it appears. I don't hear anybody doubting the fact that the Senate will pass this and President Obama will sign it. There don't seem to be any deal killers anywhere in this that I'm as we learn more about it today. Does that matter, or does it just matter that they got it done?
Well, I believe it's actually, this is the 53rd year. Now, I'm not one to credit to question.
Thank you.
You know, your authority, but it is an annual defense authorization bill, an authorization bill. It gets done every year. That's very unique in the Congress. I mean, other than appropriation measures, which, you know, for the most part have been continuing resolutions, and for the most part, you know, there are no major policy bills that have been signed into law in a long, you know, kind of a long time. And the defense authorization bill is the exception. So it's significant in its own right in terms of probably the one of the limited places where you see Washington and the Congress and the executive getting their work done in the regular order, the way it's supposed to be done. You know, that's significant, and I think it's very significant to the Pentagon and the men and women in uniform. This is the vehicle by which they get their pay, their benefits, and they get to authorize, and the Pentagon's able to go to the Congress and say, we need these laws changes to, you know, across procurement, RDT&E, personnel policy, you know, to get policy changes, to make it current, to keep the department, you know, functioning, you know, in a manner that we all hope it would. The Defense Authorization Bill is that vehicle, and it's unique across the federal government. Other federal governments really just don't have that ability.
We have a story about the NDAA, Roger, at federalnewsradio.com. The headline is Lawmakers Agree on a $585 billion Defense Bill. And the nut of where I expect to see some argument from the Pentagon, and they're not going to try to kill this, but this story says lawmakers rebuffed several of the cost-saving proposals that the Pentagon insists are necessary in a time of reduced defense spending. And the story describes the copay issue that you mentioned earlier and how that stuff was kind of negotiated down from the original position. Story mentions the A-10s will not be retired as the Pentagon's requested and some other things that will stay in there that the Pentagon had asked to come out. And it seems that will take us back, at least for positioning for the 2016 version when this comes back around next year, to the old story of Pentagon wants to do things to cut costs and Congress won't let them. And I wonder if that argument is getting old enough that it might be time to retire it and address this in some other way.
Well, you know, good points to raise. I have a slightly different perspective on this. There are differences between the Congress and the Pentagon in terms of how to save, you know, fund money and realize cost savings. At the end of the day, the Congress, through this bill, has essentially agreed to 95% to 97% of everything the Pentagon requested to be in this bill. Where they depart in terms of, I'm measuring that by kind of the dollars, you know, what they requested and what Congress authorized. You know, that 3 to 5% where they disagree, they're still playing within that same top line, and if Congress wants to continue to fund it, next year they're going to have to find the savings and cut elsewhere. So it's not like they're adding to the total spending. And in terms of the retirement and benefits, I mean, that's a real interesting one. I think you're going to see major changes next year for the following reason. You're going to have a Republican Congress for the first time, meaning both in the House and the Senate, and the fiscal hawks, I mean, those who want to reduce mandatory spending, are going to go through the process of a budget resolution, which is going to have reconciliation. And they're going to give reconciliation orders to every committee, including the Armed Services Committee, and they're going to have to reduce the mandatory spending in the Department of Defense, which we all know is primarily retirement and benefits. So look to next year for the time where you see the Congress actually addressing the benefits and retirement issues that the Pentagon's been raising for a long time.
Roger, excellent insight as always. We just have a moment left. I note that the formal title of this bill is the Carl Levin and Howard P. Buck McKeon National Defense Authorization Act for Fiscal Year 2015. Your boss, Chairman McKeon, is departing. Give me a minute or so, a couple of thoughts on the legacy that you think he leaves behind.
Yeah, thanks for that question. And I'm assuming the only reason why Carl Levin is first is because L comes before M.
I'm sure it was alphabetical, yes.
Yes. But I think Chairman McKeon, who I worked for a number of years until about a year ago in the Armed Services Committee, leaves a legacy of being kind of just myopically focused on what the Constitution charges the Congress to do, which is to Article 1, Section 8, raise and support armies and provide for the men and women in uniform. And he did that by being the most vocal opponent of sequestration and looking for every opportunity to provide funding, which fundamentally the Congress is there to do, for the warfighter. That's what he did through his four years tenure as chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and that's a fantastic legacy and one to be proud of.